Natural Agriculture and Natural Resources to order. I'm going to start with Senate Bill 673, but unless somebody on the committee complains, I'll probably move to the other two short ones at the bottom of the page and then come back to 818, which may take a little longer. There he is. I'm going to ask Judith if she'll give us some background on 673.
Good morning.
Good morning.
How are you?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Senate Bill 673 comes to us at the request of the Oregon Dungeness Crab Commission. It allows Oregon seafood harvester cooperatives or associations to negotiate with dealers or negotiating committee of dealers to establish prices of seafood. It authorizes the director of the Department of Agriculture to supervise negotiations between Oregon seafood harvester cooperative, representatives of the committee of dealers, or any Oregon seafood harvester association in establishing the price of seafood to be harvested and sold to dealers at future dates. It authorizes the director by rule to set and collect fees from parties who are participants in a regulatory program. It defines dealer, parties with respect to those participants, Oregon seafood commodity, and it also describes the regulatory program. If you look on page 2 of the bill, line 6, you'll see the intent of the regulatory program, which is to grant immunity from federal and state antitrust laws to Oregon seafood harvesters and dealers for the limited purpose of allowing the harvesters and the dealers to bargain collectively and to arrive at a negotiated price for the sale of Oregon seafood by the harvesters to the dealers. It does declare an emergency effective on passage. We do have a no revenue impact statement as well as a minimal fiscal impact statement issued on the original measure. You do also have at your seat at the dais here the Dash 1 amendments. The Dash 1 amendments provide that participation by a dealer in price negotiations is voluntary. The Dash 1 amendments also have a non revenue and a minimal fiscal impact. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Judith. I'm going to ask Nick Furman from the Oregon Dungeness Crab Commission if he would come up first this morning. We needed to hear from him before when we did this, and I just thought maybe it's a good place to start, and you can explain your perspective and why we need the bill and so on.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Nick Furman. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Dungeness Crab Commission and the Administrator of the Oregon Albacore Commission. I apologize for not being at last week's hearing. When I found out about it, I was in Boston. I got a call from the committee administrator, and that morning I was not able to make it back in quite the time. Although, compared to the minus 0 degree temperatures back there in the snow, I would have much rather been back in our balmy state of Oregon. The Crab Commission represents 450 limited entry crab permit holders in Oregon, and it's on their behalf that I offer the following comments on SB 673. Before I do, I would like to take a moment, though, to thank Senator Messerly for his willingness to work with the seafood industry on this issue, as well as Brent Seal from ODA, who encouraged us to pursue legislation similar to that which was passed for Oregon's ryegrass industry in the face of similar problems that the crab industry is currently dealing with. The Dungeness crab fishery is the most valuable single species fishery in the state of Oregon and will undoubtedly achieve the number one spot with the decline of groundfish landings due to current regulations. We are in the middle of a harvest that is on pace to come close, if not exceed, the all-time record for Dungeness crab landings in Oregon since the state started keeping track of the fishery back in 1889. Our product is enjoying nationwide demand by both food service and retail consumers, and has been singled out by the environmental community as a poster child for sustainable fisheries here on the West Coast. With that said, we have a problem that threatens to undermine one of the cornerstones of the fishery that has made the Dungeness crab Northwest's favorite crustacean and an icon of the winter holidays in our region. Because crab fishermen and seafood processors are routinely unable to come to a mutually agreeable starting price before the season officially opens on December 1, we spend valuable gear-setting time and fishing time tied to the dock, arguing, pointing fingers, and trading accusations, losing money, and most importantly, disappointing our customers and the consumer by depriving them of the ability to purchase fresh crab during a time of peak demand. In short, many in the industry feel that the process currently being used to establish a price is broken and have expressed a willingness to try anything if it means that the chaos exhibited earlier this winter can be avoided in the future. We think the piece of legislation before you can do just that. SB 673 creates a vehicle for face-to-face supervised price negotiation between crab marketing associations and Oregon's crab buyers. The proposed legislation follows the lead of the ryegrass industry, which drafted and passed a similar bill in 2001. It is designed to put a structured framework to the process that will, we believe, make it more orderly and efficient, less chaotic and acrimonious. It provides important immunity from both state and federal antitrust regulations so that both parties can come to an agreement on price after an open and candid discussion without fear of legal repercussions. What this is not is an attempt to give any one side in the price negotiations a leg up or an unfair advantage. This is not being viewed as a way to get a higher or a lower ex-vessel price at the start of the season. The bill does not compel or force anyone to the bargaining table if they don't want to participate. It simply means that that those who are willing to come together to help get the fishery started on time will have an organized process to work within. I just want to point out a couple of notes at the end of my testimony, and that is that it should be noted that when we initially discussed the concept of this legislation, we were focusing exclusively on the indigenous crab fishery. It was suggested at the last minute that the legislation be expanded to include all Oregon seafood commodities for one and one reason only, and that was that it was felt that if this process was determined to be successful for our industry and other fisheries down the line, like the shrimp fishery, or the salmon fishery, or possibly the albacore fishery, wanted to employ the same techniques being used for provided for in this legislation, that they could do so without having to create new authorization from the legislature. So that's why we expanded it. I also know that there's some concern, and some concern has been directed to this committee about government involvement and intrusion, quote unquote, in aspects of the private sector. And I don't think we view this in the industry as government intrusion or as much as government assistance in trying to provide a platform so that we can accomplish price negotiations in a reasonable, good faith, and stable situation. In terms of costs, and I know that was brought up and they said they were minimal earlier, the Department of Agriculture folks have told us that to establish the price last year in the ryegrass industry, their supervisory time and expense, which the bill provides for, cost a sum total of $300, and that included the coffee and the donuts at the negotiating meetings. The crab fishermen on the coast, up and down the coast this last year, spent over $12,500 in simply conference call fees, not to mention the time and effort and energy that, and the money lost, which some people say is up to $3 or $4 million in terms of lost revenue by not fishing during the opening of the season in December. So we think that, that in terms of a cost-to-benefit ratio, legislation like this will certainly pay for itself over a very short amount of time in our industry. And we would just like to close by saying that we hope that that you will support this. We feel that there's strong support within the industry, and that people are just now coming around to realizing that there's got to be a better way to start the fishery than what we currently use. Thank you.
Okay. Are there questions this morning?
Yeah.
Senator Byer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you have a... Or is there, I guess you wouldn't run it, is there a marketing association currently for the crab fishermen?
Each major port, we have eight major ports on the Oregon coast, eight crab ports. Five of those ports have their own marketing associations. That was a result of a similar situation that occurred about 5 or 6 years ago, where the industry found itself in trouble with the Oregon Attorney General's office for antitrust activities, because there was price discussion going on outside of the umbrella and protection of marketing associations. So the fishermen went back to their ports and established marketing associations. Right now we have five on the Oregon coast, and then our neighbors to the south and to the north of us also have similar marketing associations.
Other questions?
Senator Meyer.
Thank you. What percentage of the crab fishermen are in these marketing associations?
I would say the vast majority. I don't have a number for you, but these marketing associations are used primarily for the annual price discussion and negotiation process, and it allows the fishermen to meet collectively in the same room, to get on the conference calls, to listen to the conference calls, and to discuss price amongst each other and with their buyers without fear of antitrust activity. And so from what our indication is, the majority of the fishermen are members. The membership fees in most cases are nominal. We do have a fisherman with us here today who's a member of one of the associations in Newport, and I'm sure he can speak specifically to that. But what we see is that most people pay their dues prior to the start of the negotiations, so they're legal, and go from there.
Okay. Any other questions?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Fisher.
I don't know a whole lot about the seasons and in other areas where they harvest the crabs and those kind of things. How much of a price problem is it with crab from other areas coming on the market prior to and immediately prior to the season here?
The Dungeness crab fishery in all three states is quite similar, Washington, Oregon, and California, with the exception of a small fishery that starts on November 15th down off of San Francisco, and it's called the San Francisco or the Bay fishery. That's an exclusive fishery. It's typically produces less than 2 million pounds of crabs in comparison to Oregon landings right now are in excess of 16 million pounds for the season so far. So it's a fishery designed to produce fresh crab on the market for the Thanksgiving holiday in the San Francisco Bay Area. That fishery typically generates a higher price than the price that's achieved on the rest of the fisheries, being the Northern California, the Oregon, and the Washington fishery, simply because of its timing and its exclusivity. Once the season is open on the West Coast, the rest of the fishery, then the prices in all three states seem to find a common denominator. So typically fishermen in Northern California, up and down the Oregon coast, and also in Washington, are being paid the same starting price.
Are these crabs found no other place in the world?
Dungeness is unique. One of the things that makes it unique is the fact that it's only found in a limited range from Central California to the Gulf of Alaska, which is one of the things that makes it, it gives it its exclusive sort of gourmet type of appeal, because it's not not found in waters all over the world.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. I would suggest you don't wander too far, because maybe some other folks might make some comments, and we might want you to come back up here.
Be glad to. Thank you.
Naturally, I just sent Judith off carrying my witness list, so I can't go further at the moment. I'm going to try to move along as quickly as we can. In order of the list, Rod Moore from the West Coast Seafood Processors. I'm going to call on, and I'm going to call Al, is it Pizarre?
Yeah.
Come on up as well, would you? And he's a fisherman, so we'll just go in order, okay?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Rod Moore. I'm Executive Director of the West Coast Seafood Processors Association. We're a business trade association that represents onshore seafood processors and associated businesses in Oregon, Washington, California. Our headquarters office is located in Portland. As a business association, I need to make this clear so that we don't get in trouble with the Department of Justice. We're not involved in price negotiations or price setting. We don't have anything to do with prices. So the comments I'm offering really are sort of general in relation to the substance of the bill and the technical merits. You have before you a copy of the letter we sent to the bill's author, Senator Messerly. We have no objection to the passage of the bill. We appreciate the amendment that he has drafted up, and I believe it's before you also, which makes clear the intent of the bill that the mechanism contained therein is voluntary. While we appreciate this committee and Senator Messerly's interest in the industry, we're not entirely sure whether this bill will have the desired effect. None of our members that I've been able to contact have indicated that they would, at least initially, be willing to participate in some sort of joint price setting or price negotiation mechanism. Quite frankly, there is considerable competition among processors themselves. I'm sorry, there we go. All right, I'm trying to figure out what was causing that click. I apologize. If I were a processor sitting down with my fellow processors and with fishermen's associations, presumably I would be having to reveal some of my market channels, the financial information about my company and that sort of thing. These are proprietary pieces of information which no processing company wants to share with its fellow processors. So it is, in our view, extremely unlikely that people will actually participate in the sort of mechanism that's set up there. Having said that, if there is a feeling on behalf of the crab industry, on behalf of this committee and the legislature, that this is a good tool to have in the toolbox, and at some point it might become useful. As I say, we have no objection to the bill passing, as long as the intent is to remain voluntary in terms of participation. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
In your written testimony, you have the sentence we suggest at section 3, sub 2, sub B, be amended by adding the following: participation by a dealer in price negotiations shall be voluntary. What happens if that gets added, in your opinion?
We think it clarifies the intent of the bill, Mr. Chairman. Because the bill itself appears right now to make participation voluntary. Whether people choose or choose not to participate, obviously, is going to be up to them, and how they see their own best interests. It was unclear because of the straight language of the bill and some of the potential regulatory language that could be put in place with implementing regulations by the Department of Agriculture.
So just to get it on the record, you're saying that the bill intended this, but it just wasn't clear enough, and so you're being more explicit with the amendment.
That's correct, sir.
Okay. Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't know if you can answer this question or not, and perhaps Brent from the Department of Ag or somebody will have to, but it's my understanding with the ryegrass, the people, the premium ryegrass, it is an illegal activity for a dealer to negotiate with one of the members of the PRBA or offer a lower price than what the PRBA has set. If that's the case, I'm not positive that's still the case after the 2001 legislation, but that's what it was prior to that legislation. But if that's the case, and if the vast majority of the fishermen on the coast are members of an association, if an association sets the price, your dealers will have to pay that price, or they will be a violation of state law.
My understanding, Senator, and forgive me because I'm certainly not an expert in this area, but this comes from a very long conversation that Nick Furman and I had with Brent Searles from the Department of Agriculture, is that those members of the ryegrass, I don't know what they're called, the Ryegrass Dealers Association, who engage in negotiations with those members of the Ryegrass Growers Association, are compelled to accept whatever final price is blessed by the Department of Agriculture. But that does not preclude growers who are not members of the association or dealers who don't participate in the negotiation, in the facilitated negotiation process, from coming up with a different price on their own, whether it be higher, lower, the same, however it may be.
Mr. Chair, that's my understanding. Also, if you're talking about growers who are not members of the TRBA, but if, in fact, the vast majority of crab fishermen are already members of a bargaining association, the dealers are not going to have an opportunity, because in the ryegrass business, for instance, far less than 50% of the ryegrass growers are members of the TRBA. It's a minority of members who actually join the TRBA. But if, in fact, the fishermen are all members of marketing associations already, the dealers will have to go through the process.
If that is, in fact, the case, then that would be somewhat worrisome. If you have, there are, I don't know how many people or companies in Oregon have licenses as dealers, because you know, you or I could get a license as a dealer to simply buy crab from a fisherman in the parking lot, and then turn around and sell it to folks coming to visit the Capitol. But if the majority of the crab that is processed on the coast, or certainly in Oregon, is processed by members of our association, there are dealers of various sizes, from the very small to the very large. I don't know quite what the implications would be if, you know, the dealership composed of you and I buying out of a pickup truck agrees to negotiate with all of the fishermen's associations, and that then turns around and essentially sets the price for all of the major processing companies up and down the coast. If that is in fact the interpretation of the law, then that would be somewhat troublesome. Yes, sir.
Mr. Chair, perhaps we need to have Brent come up at some point in time, but my understanding is in the ryegrass association, the perennial ryegrass growers, as I said, far less than 50% of the ryegrass growers actually join the association. Those members are free to sell their grass at any price that they so choose with any willing buyer. Members of the association have their price set by these negotiations, and it is against the law, I believe, for any other dealer to come to those growers and try to negotiate for a different price, whether it be higher or lower, if those members are part of this association. So if you've got a fishing industry where the vast majority, if not all members, are members of the association, if those people agree to a price with a single dealer, then all other dealers, it would be prohibited to come in and offer a different price for that fish.
Senator, if I can ask, is it that other dealers would be prohibited from offering a different price, or other members of the association would be prohibited from accepting that price?
Mr. Chair, that's what we need clarification. Yeah. My understanding is that any dealer would then be prohibited from even offering, or it's illegal for a dealer, whether a member of an association or not, to bargain individually with a fisherman outside of the association of fishermen.
Could Brent clarify? I just want to keep us moving in one direction or another. If we're clear, let's get clear and maybe sure. make some decisions this morning.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Brent Searle, Department of Agriculture. Senator Beyer, and this is a somewhat cloudy question, but in the ryegrass industry, the way we address that is we try to ensure that the majority, if we have 90% of the dealers who come to the table and participate, and they, those dealers who participate have contracts with more than 90% of the PRBA growers. So in that sense, pretty well everyone who has an interest in that price is at the table. The intent of a bargaining association clearly is to represent the interests of those members. In PRBA's case, it's dependent on the bylaws of that organization. So I don't know what the bylaws are for fishermen's marketing associations and whether their members are allowed to sell some portion of their product outside of what they negotiate to some other dealer or not. So that may be a question for their associations. But the other point here is if, let's say, we have two or three dealers who represent 20% of the harvest are negotiating with the fishermen, it would be my understanding that only those dealers involved in those negotiations would be obligated to that price. At least that's how we're functioning in the ryegrass setting, is that we are trying to reach at least a threshold where most of the production is represented. In this case, there's going to be some different dynamics going on. I'm not sure there's a clear answer to the question, but I think we would have to look at what the bylaws are for the association would be one issue here.
Okay, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Bonner.
Prior to 2001, the PRBA, when they negotiated a price with a dealer, all the members of that association were locked in at that price with all the, I mean, it was the violation of law for those dealer, any other dealer, to come in and offer a lower price or a higher price to members of that association. Did we change that in the 2001 legislation?
Part of the intent of that legislation was to enable all the dealers to come to the table so that they were all negotiating over that price and there could be an agreement on it. But according to the bylaws of PRBA, once they establish a negotiated price, their growers are obligated to honor that price.
Okay.
Right. Thank you. Let's see. Al?
Yes, thank you. Chairman Shields and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today. I urge you to support Senate Bill 673, pass it, and send it to the full Senate because it makes good sense. For the record, my name is Alan Pizarre. I live at 89487 Highway 101 North in Florence. I'm an Oregon commercial fisherman and have fished for Dungeness crab for 28 years. My wife and I own and operate two commercial fishing vessels and a retail seafood market. We and the seven other families that we provide income to are very reliant on a healthy Dungeness crab fishery and market. Fisheries, especially the Dungeness crab fishery, need your help now. We have a problem which manifested itself to the proverbial biblical proportions this last November and December. Our price negotiations are a broken process and need to be fixed. Price negotiations are supposed to be an effort to discuss the best interests of harvesters and processors and to reach a balance of perceived supply and its demand. This works some of the time, recently none of the time. The fishing industry is not immune to the economic hard times the state of Oregon and the rest of the country are going through. We are going through a weeding out process both in the fleet and the processing sector, and only the strong will survive. This process has moved maybe 60%, by my estimation, of the Dungeness crab on the West Coast to one buyer. This consolidation has proved to complicate and hinder the preseason price negotiation process. Smaller buyers, and all other buyers are smaller buyers, are reluctant to stick their neck out with a price for fear will be undercut and everything they have bought will have to be sold at no profit or a loss. December 1 is the scheduled season opener. Crabs are sought when their meat has filled out new shells after molting and growing. The month of December is traditionally the time the consumer expects this new crop of crab. Ads are run by supermarkets. Fishermen go fishing. Cannery workers go to work. Seafood markets sell crabs. The coastal economy hums. Not this season. We sat through a lengthy and bitter price dispute. We sacrificed 3 weeks of prime marketing and withheld a public resource from a hungry consumer. And at the end of it all, we didn't get near the value for this year's harvest that we should have. Coastal communities felt the blow. Crewmen, cannery workers, captains, entire coastal communities from Astoria to Brookings suffered. Many had no Christmas presents under the tree for their family. It was very painful, and it didn't need to be. We have an opportunity to fix the problem. An organized, formal framework is needed to eliminate the chaos that has developed around our price negotiations. House Bill 3811 was passed by the Oregon State Legislature and signed by the governor in May 2001. This allowed the ryegrass industry bargaining associations to meet directly with the dealers under direct supervision of the Oregon Department of Agriculture. We in the Dungeness crab industry have the same problem that was fixed for ryegrass by House Bill 3811. Senate Bill 673 extends the same process and protection from state and federal antitrust laws to the fishing industry. The Oregon Dungeness Crab Commission has taken the lead for the industry in promoting Senate Bill 673. Listen to what Nick Furman, Executive Director, has to say. The Dungeness crab fishery is the single most valuable fishery in the state of Oregon. It is biologically a well-managed, sustainable, environmentally friendly fishery that many look to for answers to management problems they are having in other fisheries. Please take this opportunity to help stabilize the marketing end of this valuable state resource. An orderly and efficient price negotiation process outlined by Senate Bill 673 will allow this to occur. Please pass Senate Bill 673. And I apologize, I banged this out about 3 o'clock this morning when I got the call late last night, but I had a couple other points I wanted to hit on, if I may, before I ask for questions or take any questions. One, I think it's important that we clarified it earlier, that this is not a mandatory program. It's voluntary for buyers to participate. It gives the opportunity for whoever wants to be there, especially the smaller buyers that are afraid to stick their neck out, to come to the table and negotiate prior to the season when it gets critical, in good faith. Second, the safety issue. Any delay in the opening of our traditional December 1 season, if the crabs are ready, puts huge pressure on boats to compete. The fleet has grown in size. The individual size of the boat has grown to the point where a little smaller boat wants to compete with the big boys. He's got to get out there when the weather is sometimes marginal. We had a disaster on the coast last year, not this last season, but the prior one. Maybe you heard about it. And we lost a boat and 4 good men because, I think, directly because of a delay. I think if we can get the price negotiation process underway November, prior to the season, have something established, takes the pressure off everybody. We have a orderly lay time, a grace period, the second year, which enables the smaller vessels to compete with the bigger vessels. When we delay, we take that away, and it's a free-for-all, and it's not a pretty sight. The third point I wanted to hit on was the December sales. A huge amount of crabs harvested in December go as fresh whole cooks. After the New Year's, Christmas period, except for maybe Super Bowl weekend, very few of the crab are going as fresh product anymore. They're going into the freezers. And we need that first 3-4 weeks of the season to market those crabs, get maximum value for them, and rather than just stuff them all in the freezer. We put them all in the freezer, we got a big pack that we have to shake in sections all summer and fall, which complicates the negotiations for the prior season. This year, we're sitting on a huge pack in the freezer that's going to have to go somewhere before we're ever going to see a price again. I'm glad Nick Furman put a figure on the estimated losses this year due to the delay, $3 to $4 million. I don't have any way of quantifying it myself, but I'll go with that. It was substantial. You asked Senator Beyer what percentage of fishermen are members of associations. I live in Florence, fish in Newport. I've fished in several ports up and down the coast, been to several different marketing association meetings and been members of them. And I would say 75% probably are members, but when there's a delay, that increases because everybody wants to be in the loop. And the only way they can get that information legally and discuss price is to be a member of an association. So during a delayed season, it may even be 90%. That's about all I have. If there's any questions.
Thank you. Any questions?
Yeah, sure.
Yes.
And, you know, I don't know the fishing industry at all. You know somewhat about the grass seed industry. And when times are good, when grass seed prices are stable or rising, the grass seed growers are more likely to join the PRBA because, you know, they perceive it has some value. But what we saw in 1999, not actually later than that, 2000, I guess, when the grass seed industry was collapsing and prices were going from the 60-cent range for ryegrass down to the 30-cent range, you saw that's when the PRBA membership collapsed because people had contracts with the PRBA to sell their grass seed for 60 cents, yet dealers were not willing to pay more than 30. So at that point in time, farmers being who they are, you can't hold a commodity like grass seed and think I'll sell it next year at a higher price. It has to be sold. Banks require it. I mean, just the inventory has to move. So that is the what I perceive as a problem with the PRBA is that it works fine potentially in stable markets or increasing markets, but farmers are independent people, and as soon as they perceive that, you know, I'm locked in at a 60-cent price, I can get 40 cents and get my money, they all bail and do that and quit the association. Would that happen in the fishing industry also?
Senator Beyer, I fished for 28 years. Maybe half of them have been delayed because of price negotiations. It's rare that crabs are sold on the coast in any of the three states at a big difference to a standard processing. There's a live market which commands a higher price, which is understood, but the crabs that go to the plant, we call it, or the cannery, they go and they get sectioned, they get put into meat, frozen, whatever, go through the channels, are pretty much the same price. It's in everybody's best interest to keep that price stable and constant throughout the coast. I believe that the participation by the buyers, that the competition for the product, because nobody really knows what's on the grounds until you have a look at it. The crab, there might be a lot, there might not be. We don't know until we've been out a couple times and looked at the gear. But the competition will be fierce for buyers to line up for those crabs, especially in the years where they think there's fewer, less product. I don't think that boatloads of crabs are going to come in and be sold cheap. In answer to your question, I guess that's what you say. When the price isn't stable or going up, it's basically a free-for-all by non-members. Is that what you're...
Well, more when the price is going down.
Uh-huh.
The
price doesn't go down on crab. It just doesn't rise as fast once the season starts. Well, this year was an exception, wasn't it? Yes. The only exception that I know of.
Yeah. That actually was about 2 years ago. There was another weird one, I remember. It was 2 years ago.
Yeah, it's very unusual for that to happen.
I could realize what the prices are. I don't know.
Yeah, they're a lot lower than they should be right now.
I think, rather than this debate, I'm going to call Nick Furman to come back. I'm also Roger Martin is the only one who hasn't testified. He's signed up, so I'm just going to invite the two of them up. You guys are welcome to sit near the front if you want and engage. We've got to decide to do something. I'm kind of at the position of let's decide to decide or not to decide, but let's do something, you know, here pretty quick. Roger, I'll let you take off here. Nick, I asked you back because I thought maybe you might have some insights on some of the questions that Senator Byers raised. But, Roger, let's let you have at it for a minute first.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Roger Martin, and I represent Pacific Seafood, which I think the crab fishermen referred to as the 60% buyer on the coast. We're very concerned about the prospects for this bill and what it sets up. Just let me review again. This season started late. I understand from talking to the Department of Fish and Wildlife, they set the season later at the request of fishermen, so it coincided with the state of Washington. Then the negotiations of price went on, and what happened is not enough crab was available to go to that Christmas market that was talked about earlier. The price was low, and I mentioned to you earlier, all last fall the price in Alaska was about $1.10 or less a pound. Alaska produces a lot of Dungeness crab. We're in a world market, and now all of us appreciate that Dungeness crab is the finest. The Dungeness crab is the finest crab there is. Better than anything on the East Coast. But if you do, as I do, I watch the Food Channel. I'm kind of a nut. I watch the Food Channel all the time. Emeril Lagasse, time and again, is giving recipes for use of crab. It is always crab they get on the East Coast. He does not promote or talk about Dungeness crab. I think any of us that eat a lot of fish understand that the spring Chinook out of the Columbia River is the finest salmon available. It's better than any other salmon anywhere, yet the price for Copper River salmon out of Alaska is much higher per pound. They've done a better marketing job of it. It's recognized all over the world. But the average person eats pen-raised salmon, which is a heck of a lot lower price-wise than the Columbia River salmon or anything else. It's having an effect on the market. We are in a world market. Pacific Seafood buys all over the West Coast and in other parts of the world. My concern is this is going to set up an anticipation. In spite of the fact that it's, quote, voluntary and you can participate or not, I think you must have heard the voice of the crab fishermen. We pass this bill, we solve our problems. Now, that assumes that government agencies can get together and have people negotiate in what, again, is a competitive market and set up some kind of a price that will be, and he will not be happy unless the price is high enough to satisfy the fishermen. And I understand that. We all understand that. This is a depressed, we're going through a recession right now, and the market worldwide for crab and other more sophisticated seafood is down. People buy the lesser priced product. A lot more tuna fish is being eaten right now than crab or canned shrimp. I think it's somewhat of, I think, naive to think that you can compare this to the Ryegrass Commission. Ryegrass is grown almost exclusively in the Willamette Valley. We all know that other competition from other countries has caused that to drop drastically in the last few years. Setting up a governing commission probably has not solved the farmer's overall problem. The other thing that, from our standpoint, we're concerned about is this whole involvement of government. We've had a very bad experience in the last 2 years with the Oregon Department of Justice. We've spent over $1 million on legal fees defending ourselves on what I think I could convince you it took enough time was totally frivolous kind of charges. Right now, the crab fishermen have been sending letters to the Department of Justice accusing us of antitrust. They haven't done anything at the Department of Justice. They're kind of accumulating the letters, deciding whether they're going to, quote, open a file and start an amicable negotiation. We're simply saying to them, the price doesn't warrant. Now, it did go up. It started off at $1.25 a pound. It's higher than that. Afterwards, but I think very accurately, the crab fisherman pointed out that after you get through the first of the year, the market dies down, and most of that's going to end up in frozen or canned crab. I'm just concerned that there's an anticipation here that I hear it in the voices of the people that want the bill. I don't think there's any very good correlation between Ryegrass Commission or Ryegrass negotiation process and crab, but I'll leave that to your decision. And if you talk to anybody that's been active in this business, the crab fishermen are very, very emotional people. There have been, I mentioned in my previous testimony, in Northern California, a dead horse head ended up on the bow of a boat of one of the crab fishermen that dared to go out when the others didn't want him going out. And I've talked to crab fishermen tell you that rifle shots through wheelhouses, all kinds of things happen. If you dare to defy the majority of the fishermen, you're going to get in a lot of trouble. Tire slash would be one of the lesser things that happens. So we don't want war. We just don't think this is a very good solution, or we haven't heard the convincing argument that this is going to solve the problems. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Roger, you said once or twice that in the voice of the fishermen you sense that they feel that this will solve the problem. I'm suggesting that even if it may solve the problem, it may not, it might be a worthwhile tool in the toolbox. How do you respond to that? Is there a negative side?
It might be. Just the experience I've had in 30 years of seeing government solve business problems. Government doesn't do a very good job of solving business problems, and this is a market. We're not going to affect the world market. We can try. It would be nice if we all sat down peacefully and negotiated, but...
Yeah. Nick, I sent a note to Senator Messerly a few minutes ago, and since he's sponsoring the bill, I wanted to get some feedback from him. He says that you're the guy that has the credibility to make the case. So we're sitting here in confusion, it seems to me, on the committee. Can you help us?
If I may, I appreciate the opportunity to come back and hopefully answer a few questions. I have the advantage, I guess, of responding to other people's comments. Then I'll try not to take advantage of that. First of all, I think what the bill, the concept of the bill, is to try to establish a starting price only. We have what's called a Derby or an Olympic fishery, and envision taking the value of the fishery is anywhere between $24 and $36 million. And so you take, we use a low number for discussion purposes, say $24 million, and put it out in the center of a room, and then circle that room with 450 crab permit holders who have been tied to the dock for 2 or 3 months, waiting for the crab season to start in anticipation of December 1st opener. And all of a sudden the ODF&W says, on your mark, or gentlemen, start your engines, then on your mark, get set, go. And it's a mad dash for the cash. We land upwards of 80% of the total production for the entire season in the first 8 weeks of the fishery. It is a very, very competitive fishery, and it's a very, very emotional fishery, like Roger just told you. It's emotional because if you read USA Today last week, it just happened to come out while the entire industry was back at the Boston Seafood Show. The commercial fishing industry is the number one most dangerous industry in the United States, more so than mining, fire, police, and so forth on down the line. It is very emotional. There's a lot of money involved, and when you combine those circumstances, you end up in a situation where it can be volatile. That's the exact reason why we feel that our industry needs this type of supervised process, so that we don't end up with the tire slashing that was referred to, that we don't end up with the legal bills in defense of antitrust allegations which have come on both sides. Fishermen suffered from that same issue 5 or 6 years ago and spent a lot of money to defend themselves. This year, processors have been under the microscope in terms of accusations, and they're only accusations of antitrust. That's the exact reason why a number of people in the industry came to the Crab Commission and said, started the dialogue of there's got to be a better way to do this. We can't, nobody wants to deal with the horse's head on the bowels of the wheelhouse. Nobody wants to deal with the investigation from the Attorney General's office and all the headlines that produces in the Oregonian up and down the state every fall. And so we feel that by having a process, and that's all we're looking at, this is just a process. This is just and like I said earlier, it's not, it should not be viewed as government intrusion, simply as a vehicle so that the industry can get together, we can discuss
our issues, discuss our price, discuss aspects of the market that would contribute to a fair price, and then go from there. We know that once the fishery gets started, once the pots are in the water, and we determine how much crab is out there, that the laws of supply and demand are going to employ, and the price is going to take care of itself. As it was referred to, in most cases, it goes up as the production goes down. Some years, that's not always the case. A couple of comments just to correct any misconceptions. First of all, there are four states and one other country that produce Dungeness crab. Alaska, that was referred to in the earlier testimony you heard, is actually the number five producer of Dungeness crab. Dungeness crab is a very, very, I won't say insignificant, but a very small portion of the total seafood economy in Alaska. Oregon is the number two producer and has been, except for last year where we produced the number one, beat out Washington for once in a decade. But Washington is typically number one, Oregon is number two. There is a big market for frozen crab. There is money made in frozen crab. What we're trying to do is get the fishery started so that we can get to that point where we start freezing crab. And we see this bill as an opportunity to do that. We think that fishermen will participate as long as everybody goes into it with honest and legitimate expectations. We feel that this legislation will serve the industry well. The other thing I think it's very important to note, and everybody's brought that up, is that this, because it's not compulsory and it's not mandatory, if this doesn't work, then we can say that we tried, that we get an A for effort, and continue to seek out a remedy, a method, and ways to solve our problems. If this does work, then all the better.
Okay. Thank you for sharing. I'm going to let you guys step back for a minute. I'm going to close the hearing on Senate Bill 673, and I'm going to go to a work session on 673, and I'm going to just tell you what I'm thinking at the moment. I have great respect for Senator Messerly, and he brought the bill. It doesn't seem to me as if there's any guarantees about anything these days. This may help. So I'm willing to entertain a motion. I think we ought to adopt the amendment to make that portion clear. Then we can adopt the bill as amended, send it to the floor. If for some reason, and I want to say this particularly to Nick Furman, if there is a problem with this bill, Senator Messerly can certainly call it back or send it back to us in committee. So with that understanding, I'm open to amendments or whatever you guys want to do.
Mr. Chair, before we
sure.
do that, I too am willing to send the bill to the floor if it's amended. I don't think this bill is going to do what the crab fishermen think it will do. And I think that is my concern, is that because I have seen what happens in the ryegrass industry, I just don't think that this bill is the panacea that some people are thinking it is, and in fact it may create more problems than it solves. I don't know that because I don't know the fishing industry. I'm willing to send the bill to the floor. I don't know that I'll vote for the bill on the floor, and perhaps someone could convince me to vote for the bill on the floor. But I'm willing to give it a shot to get to the floor and let it be debated there to see, you know, what happens with it. But I just, my concern is that in an industry like, from what I understand, the fishing industry is that you've got 90% of the production in the associations. The dealers will have to go to those associations to bargain, even though it is voluntary. And if they don't, you're going to have a worse stalemate than what you've got today. And that's my concern, because if you've got a dealer or two, the biggest dealers in the coast, who are not willing to go to the association to bargain, then you haven't solved anything. You may have made the problem worse. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'd move to amend the bill with the dash one amendments.
Senator Beyer has suggested the dash one amendments. Is there any objection? If not, the amendments are added.
You have,
huh? Oh.
Mr. Chair, I would move Senate Bill 673 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Beyer moves Senate Bill 673 to the floor with a due pass recommendation, as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
I have concerns similar to Senator Beyer.
So do I.
And having been involved in an association that was involved with the FTC, trumped up violation and the problems we had to try to extricate ourselves from something that 25 years ago was close to a $250,000 process. Now that means it's probably several million-dollar process. It wasn't any fun. I wouldn't wish that on anybody, and I wouldn't wish to do anything that would cause that. But I'm willing to go ahead with this and get it to the floor, and if something does come up involving it, it still has to go through the House. There is a chance to bring it back to committee, so there's several possibilities to work with it.
Right. Chair, I just like, if Senator Fisher is down, I just say again, I don't know that I will vote for the bill once it gets to the
right.
floor. I'm sending it out as a courtesy to you and the committee to let it be debated, because we don't have our fourth member here.
And I'm also doing the same. Senator Messerly is the one that lives down on the coast, and I'm assuming that he and Mr. Furman will be talking, and they can figure out whether we should proceed. And with that, I'd just like to call for the roll.
Senator Corcoran? Senator Fisher?
Aye.
Vice Chair Beyer?
Aye.
Chair Shields?
Aye. And with that, we'll assign this bill to Senator Messerly and let him try to figure it out. With that, I'm going to close the hearing on Senate Bill 673, and I think it's my prerogative to change my mind, so I'm going to do Senate Bill 818 as we planned, because I don't even know if we're going to have time to get to the other two at this point. We've been talking a lot today, so Judith, I'll let you do the speed talking and ask everybody else to follow your example.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Senate Bill 818 comes to us under the sponsorship of Senator Devlin. The measure requires a person selling or distributing a product containing elemental mercury or mercury compounds to notify the Director of Human Services. It prohibits the sale of a product containing mercury without a label. It specifies the contents of that label. It provides for civil penalties for violation of mercury labeling requirements not to exceed $10,000. And it requires those selling mercury compounds by catalog, telephone, or internet to advise the purchaser that the product does contain mercury. Further, the measure requires a manufacturer of a mercury product to develop a plan for recycling and collection of that product. It defines manufacturer. It specifies contents of the recycling and collection plan, which you will find on page two, beginning on line one. And it requires a report to the Department of Environmental Quality on the effectiveness of those plans. Finally, it directs the Environmental Quality Commission to identify persons holding air quality or water quality permits that allow emission of more than 10 pounds of mercury per year. It directs those identified persons to submit a mercury reduction plan to DEQ, and that those reduction plan requirements are found on page 3, beginning on line 4. And it does direct the department to require reductions in mercury emissions under certain conditions. We have received a no revenue impact statement on the measure. We are still waiting on the fiscal. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And let's just hustle right into the testimony on this. First, an old friend, former State Representative Gail Shibley, is here to testify on the bill. Gail, welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, Gail Shibley, Administrator for Public Health Systems, the State of Oregon, DHS. As you may note on the testimony sign-up sheet, I am not here today to provide testimony, but do want to make our department available to try to provide any information.
Okay. I didn't read that far across. And I just was informed that Senator Devlin managed to sneak in while I wasn't looking, so let's ask him to come forward. Don't worry, Gail, he'll more than make up for your loss of words this morning.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Richard Devlin, State Senator, Senate District 19, for the record. I will probably make up for more than Ms. Shibley's testimony by far, but let me start off by saying that last week I testified on behalf of Senate Bill 817, a bill creating a program to clean up Oregon's abandoned mercury mines. I am here today to testify on behalf of Senate Bill 818. This bill would continue efforts to eliminate mercury pollution in our state by labeling mercury-added products and ensuring that they are either recycled or properly disposed of, and also reducing mercury discharges from industrial point sources. In 2001, the legislature passed House Bill 3007, prohibiting or limiting the manufacture, sale, installation, or disposal of specified mercury-containing items. The bill phased out commonly used products such as mercury thermometers and thermostats, but there are still many sources of mercury that the bill did not address. Senate Bill 818 would require manufacturers of any product that contains mercury to notify the state that their product is sold in Oregon. This would give public officials better information about the full and true extent of how much mercury is in products being sold in our state. Second, all mercury added products would have to be labeled, giving consumers much needed information about the contents of the products that they use. Lastly, manufacturers of mercury added products would have to develop a collection system for managing these products at the end of their useful life. These collection systems are to be set up by the manufacturers, thus allowing them to decide details permitting maximum flexibility. Senate Bill 818 would also establish a program to reduce mercury discharges from industrial point sources. This program would require DEQ to identify all facilities that are expected to emit more than 10 pounds of mercury in a year, either to the air or water. Any facility that does emit more than 10 pounds of mercury per year would develop a plan to voluntarily reduce the mercury emissions by 50% by the year 2010. If the voluntary efforts outlined by facilities fail to reduce overall mercury emissions in Oregon by 2010, DEQ will require facilities to reduce those emissions to the goal of 50% by the year 2012. In considering this bill, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I think there are four basic questions that should be answered. One is, does mercury pollution pose a significant health threat to Oregonians? Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, abandoned mines, industrial pollution, and an array of mercury-added products all contribute to Oregon's environmental mercury burden of an estimated 4,500 pounds of emissions per year. Mercury is known to be an extremely toxic substance that can cause harm to human health. It attacks the central nervous system of the body and can cause harm to the brain, kidneys, and lungs. Methylmercury, which is the most lethal form of mercury, builds up in the food chain. The National Academy of Science estimates that 60,000 children per year in America are born with prenatal exposure to mercury at a level above what is considered safe. What this means, in effect, is that one out of every 11 American women of childbearing age has mercury levels that may endanger a child that's born to them and lead to possible permanent disabilities for that child. Is Oregon, in a sense, stepping into some direction? This is the second question, that is uncharted territory. That's not the case at all, actually. Connecticut, Maine, New Hampshire, Minnesota, Vermont, and Rhode Island now require notification from manufacturers about the sale of mercury-added products and or require labels on these products. Further, Connecticut, Maine, Minnesota, and Rhode Island all have laws that require mercury-added product manufacturers to take responsibility for collecting certain mercury-added products at the end of their useful life. Oregon should follow the example of these states and take an active stance against mercury pollution. Third question basically is there some benefit to resisting change, or is there some benefit of getting ahead of the curve? The question basically is would Oregon be alone in trying to reduce mercury discharges from industrial point sources? No, they would not. Wisconsin and Massachusetts are imposing new rules on industrial facilities that require them to significantly reduce their mercury emissions. Furthermore, other states like New Jersey and Michigan already include mercury emission limits and monitoring requirements and permits for industrial point sources. Final question, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, is these bills, both of the bills, 817 and 818, are relatively complex. They're difficult in terms of their complexity, and in this day and age of particular budget shortfalls, it's hard to imagine that we might have the resources to implement them fully, even if we did have the desire to do so. So the question that's being asked is, if the resources do not exist to fully implement the mercury pollution reduction program envisioned in Senate Bill 817 and 18, are there portions of the bill that could be implemented now? And the answer that I would give is yes. A careful examination of each of the elements of these bills reveals initial steps that could be taken now if the legislature so desired, that would ultimately benefit the health of Oregonians for generations to come. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, in 2001, I worked with then-Representative Witt and current Representative Merkley to pass legislation to reduce mercury pollution in Oregon. That legislation came about because environmental and industrial interests reached a reasonable compromise to protect the public interest. I believe the members of this committee and I both believe that Oregonians deserve no less from us now than they did in 2001.
Thank you. Any questions? I appreciate your coming and sharing with us this morning. It'll be an interesting testimony. You're welcome to stick around if you have the time.
Mr. Chairman, I have to go to a very vital OLCC budget hearing. But at the same time, one thing I would like to point out, I do notice a lot of utility representatives in the back here who will probably be talking about a lot of products that save energy that contain mercury. And I would like to point out that none of these bills prohibit those products, and that a distributor of a product that has to be labeled in four or five of these states that have labeling requirements is probably under no great burden to label products that come to Oregon also.
Thank you. Good point. Good point. Laura Weiss is next on my list.
Good morning.
Laura, thank you for coming.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Laura Weiss. I'm with the Oregon Environmental Council. And I'm here today to express OEC's support for Senate Bill 818. This bill, along with its companion, Senate Bill 817, will better protect Oregon's health and environment by reducing mercury pollution from the three major sources of mercury in Oregon: abandoned mines, products, and industrial point sources. Although some of us did play with this silvery substance as children, we now know that when mercury enters the environment, it can lead to serious and long-lasting pollution problems. Mercury is a highly toxic chemical that can have profound and long-term impacts on the human brain and nervous system, and is especially dangerous for infants and children. Excuse me a moment. That might be better. A new EPA study has concluded that about 5 million women in the United States have levels of mercury in their blood that increase the risk that children may suffer irreversible damage to their nervous systems, and that can result in problems such as reduced attention span, memory problems, and problems with motor skills such as hand-eye coordination. So these problems are subtle but significant. I think we need to look at reducing mercury from all sources. Mercury comes from three major sources, as I mentioned, and DEQ estimates that that totals about 4,500 pounds of mercury a year in Oregon's environment. That is a staggering amount, considering that it takes only a gram of mercury to contaminate a 20-acre lake so the fish are unsafe to eat.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Fisher.
I just object to that kind of an argument. You don't have any idea the size of a 20-acre lake, whether it's 1 inch deep or 200 feet deep or anything else. That's a ridiculous statement.
Can you continue your testimony?
I certainly can. As this committee has heard, mercury does occur naturally in the environment. However, many studies tell us that human activities have significantly increased the amount of mercury that is currently cycling in the atmosphere, in soils, in streams, and oceans. In fact, the US EPA estimates that human activity has contributed 50% to 70% of the mercury in the global environment. While there is little that we can do about naturally occurring mercury, there are many steps we can take to reduce and ultimately eliminate the environmental release of mercury from human activities. Senate Bill 818 would reduce mercury pollution from mercury-added products by requiring, A, that manufacturers notify the state about the products they sell, B, requiring all manufacturers of mercury-added products to label their products, and C, require that certain producers take responsibility to safely dispose of the mercury-containing products they sell. Just quickly, the reason for these parts of the bill are as follows. Notification of the state will give public officials better information about the full extent of how much mercury is in products being sold in the state. We know that there are a whole number of products out there, but we don't really have a good sense of what they are and how many are being sold in the state, and this will give us better information. At the same time, labeling these products will provide consumers with information they need about the contents of products they purchase and hopefully help keep some of those products out of the waste stream. All of this information will allow us to do a better job of keeping mercury from these products out of the waste stream and out of the environment. As has been previously mentioned, several states have already passed laws along these lines. Lastly, under Senate Bill 818, manufacturers of certain mercury-added products such as appliances, automobiles, and RVs would have to develop a collection system for managing these products at the end of their useful life. Again, other states have taken this road before Oregon has. The last thing I want to address is the part of the bill that deals with mercury from industrial point sources. The unfortunate reality is that our current regulatory system is failing to control the release of mercury from industrial facilities. Several types of industrial activities release mercury into the environment. That includes coal-fired power plants, cement kilns, steel mills, municipal waste incinerators, and some pulp and paper facilities. All these facilities occur in Oregon. However, none of these facilities, with the exception of the municipal waste incinerators, are required to limit their discharge of mercury or even to monitor their mercury emissions. Senate Bill 818 would require facilities that release more than 10 pounds of mercury per year, or expected to release more than 10 pounds per year, to monitor their mercury emissions and develop a voluntary mercury action plan, reduction plan. DEQ would be required to fill the gaps in existing permits by including limits for mercury in all relevant permits. If these voluntary efforts that give these industries a lot of flexibility in how to do their reductions of mercury fail to reduce mercury by 50% in the next 7 years, then DEQ would be given the authority to require those reductions. As has previously been mentioned, other states are already including mercury emission limits in permits, and they're also requiring facilities overall to significantly reduce their mercury emissions. There are several ways that facilities can reduce their mercury emissions, and this bill recognizes that and gives the facilities the flexibility to develop and implement their own plan to cut mercury emissions in half over the next 7 years. We know that controlling mercury pollution from industrial facilities is possible. In point of fact, the waste-to-energy or municipal solid waste incinerator down the road in Brooks installed a carbon injection technology in 1998 for the purpose of controlling mercury. That same technology, as well as others, can be used by other types of facilities in the state. In summary, Senate Bill 818 will go a long way toward our common goal of reducing the health threats posed by mercury pollution. In conjunction with Senate Bill 817, it ensures that we are addressing the mercury problem comprehensively from all major sources of mercury in the state. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Thank you very much for coming forward, Lauren.
Thank you very much.
The next person on the list is Rhett Lawrence, is that right? As Senator Fisher noted, have to be careful about generalizations. Obviously, there's a difference between a lake that's an inch deep and one that may be 20 feet. Or I used to jog around Crater Lake. It was about, 1,000 feet deep. So I understand his concern, and I do want to avoid generalizations.
Sure. Thank you, Chair Shields. For the record, my name is Rhett Lawrence. I'm an environmental advocate with OSPIRG, Oregon State Public Interest Research Group. We're a nonprofit, nonpartisan public interest advocacy group with more than 25,000 members across the state of Oregon. And I'm pleased to appear before you today to urge you to support Senate Bill 818. As you all likely know and have heard already today, mercury is an extremely potent and persistent neurotoxin that accumulates in the body and in the environment over time. The human health impacts of mercury are well known, and you've already heard some of those today. Children and babies are especially susceptible to the dangers of mercury. Exposure to mercury causes learning disabilities in children and can cause brain damage and developmental delays in fetuses. And in addition to mercury's human health impacts, its more general environmental impacts are also a great cause for concern. Since mercury is a metal, natural processes cannot break it down, and so any amount released to the environment will remain there forever. And unfortunately, the hazards of mercury are not just a theoretical problem in Oregon. We've worked hard over the years at OSPIRG to help clean up the Willamette River, which you all know has become a toxic mess. And the entire main stem of the Willamette is under a fish consumption advisory right now because of mercury contamination, as are 10 other lakes and rivers in the state. Abandoned mines, industrial discharges, and products containing mercury are all contributing to our state's environmental ills. And while we did make some progress in the 2001 legislature by passing a bill to reduce mercury pollution by phasing out some products, there's still much work to be done in the state to get a handle on our mercury problem. Senate Bill 818 is the next logical step down that road. The bill's labeling requirements will protect the public interest and consumer choice by giving Oregonians important information about the products they buy. In addition, by requiring manufacturers of mercury-added products to develop a recycling and collection plan regarding how they will deal with these products when they are no longer useful, we can keep a large amount of this mercury out of the waste stream. As you have heard, several other states have already enacted such laws. The bill also contains important provisions for reducing mercury discharges from industrial point sources. But rather than impose dramatic reduction mandates on industry in Oregon, as some other states have done, as you've heard, this bill would first start out as a voluntary reduction effort and then only involve DEQ if those voluntary efforts fail. So in conclusion, OSPIRG believes that the provisions of Senate Bill 818 are absolutely critical to take Oregon to the next level in getting rid of mercury pollution in our state. These are common sense and reasonable proposals, which yet will have a great impact on human health and the environment. And for these reasons, we urge you to give Senate Bill 818 your support. So thank you for your time, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Questions? If not, I want to go ahead. You can step back. I want to just take a little personal privilege break in the proceedings. I have a shadow for today, and I'm going to ask my legislative aide if he'll just let him come up and sit up here in the end of the committee.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Would
Senator
you allow the same privilege?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
My job shadow, Sarah, would you come up?
Sarah, come on up. You can sit here near Senator Fisher.
I'm supposed to have one, too, but I don't...
Yeah, you haven't found yours yet.
I haven't found them yet. I've lost my shadow.
My apologies, Senator Fisher. I would have invited your shadow up earlier if I had known about her being here. Maybe we could turn the committee over to these kids, and they'd do a better job than we're doing. Who knows? There's people in the audience that just said yes, we agree. Jeff Bickford from Marion County. Welcome to our committee this morning.
Mr. Chairman, Senators, thank you for letting me be here this morning. My name is Jeff Fickford, and I'm the manager of Marion County Public Works Environmental Services Division, which includes the county's solid waste management section. I'm here to speak today in support of Senate Bill 818, the Mercury Monitoring and Reduction Act. Marion County utilizes an integrated approach to solid waste management. This means that we use all the tools available to deal with the waste generated by our citizens and businesses. A key piece in our solid waste system is the Marion County Waste Energy Facility located in Brooks. That's already been spoken about. There, waste is burned, producing electricity that is sold into the local power grid, to PGE. This facility began operations in 1986 and was a significant investment for our county. It has maintained an excellent environmental compliance record over all these years. In response to changes in federal environmental law, mercury reduction control technology was added to this facility, and it came online in May 1998. This consists of the injection of powdered activated carbon into the flue gas coming from the facility's boilers. It cost Marion County approximately $1.3 million to install this technology, with ongoing operating costs being about $100,000 per year for operations and maintenance. In order to reduce the amount of mercury being sent to this facility in the first place, Marion County has implemented several recycling collection programs at our expense aimed at products that contain mercury. These include mercury-containing fluorescent lamps, mercury-containing batteries, and mercury thermometers. In 2002, the department spent approximately $4,000 to recycle those materials, keeping them out of our waste stream and away from our waste energy facility. Marion County supports Senate Bill 818 for a number of reasons. First, we feel that it makes sense for all businesses and industries that discharge mercury to be responsible for lowering their emissions in order to help protect public health and the environment. Waste energy has already been required to step up and reduce their emissions, and we have. However, these same general reduction requirements should apply to all other industries that are emitting this potent toxin. Everyone should be on an equal footing in the effort to reduce mercury reductions. Secondly, we support the concept of product labeling for consumer items that contain mercury. Hopefully, through making informed decisions, consumers will eventually buy less of these products, resulting in the reduction of these materials eventually ending up in the waste stream after their end of life. This means less mercury needing to be managed arriving at our disposal facilities. But lastly, we also support the concept of the eventual development of a collection system funded by the product manufacturers. This would help to relieve the burden currently placed upon local governments, such as Marion County, to subsidize collection and recycling programs for these materials. While this likely will result in the manufacturers simply passing on this cost to consumers in the price of their products, the public needs to be aware and responsible for the full true cost of the products that they purchase. In summary, Marion County supports Senate Bill 818 as currently presented. We feel that this bill will help to reduce the total amount of mercury distributed in our communities, further protecting human health and the environment. We feel that it will help to level the playing field so that all industries are responsible for lowering their emissions, not just a chosen few. Additionally, the proposed manufacturer labeling collection program should have the effect of reducing the amount of mercury received at disposal facilities statewide and help to lift the financial burden of handling these products after their end of life away from local governments.
Jeff, Marion County spent a lot of money in Brooks there installing the technology and more to run it and more to get mercury waste out of the waste stream before you end up at the trash burning site.
Correct.
In that process, I'm assuming y'all did a cost-benefit analysis. Can you comment on that in terms of
as far
health,
as the
health considerations and so on?
Senator, as far as the installation of the original technology, there wasn't a lot of cost-benefit analysis available. It was basically mandated in the federal Clean Air Act standards. So that was what we had to do it. It wasn't an option.
Okay.
So that's.
So you still haven't done anything like that?
No, it was required, and now it's just basically maintaining and continuing that operation.
Did the federal government help you with the purchase price of the technology?
Of course not.
Of course.
Okay. And it achieves also 99.9%.
Okay.
Removal versus the 50% that we're...
You do realize that you answered your question before you answered your question with that cynical laugh that you had.
Of course.
Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious what the process Marion County came to come forward and endorse this bill.
Besides reviewing it, of course, the commissioners reviewed my testimony as well as the Public Works Director. And we feel we need to support this.
So, Ms. Clifford, your commissioners...
The commissioners have reviewed my testimony.
Thank you.
Correct.
Hmm. Any other questions? Oh, Senator Fisher, yes.
Mr. Chair, what do you do with this mercury after you remove it?
At the waste energy facility? Yeah. It ends up in the ash. Basically, the mercury that's volatilized in the combustion chambers, it adheres to that activated carbon, which ends up getting collected in our baghouses and ends up in our ash stream. Our ash goes to a special ash monofill or landfill that we're only ashes landfill, and it's triple lined. We collect any leachate that comes out. mercury isn't as it's adhered to the carbon, doesn't leach. So basically, it's entombed in an ash zone. So you're getting it out, and you're putting it in a different location where basically it's out of the environment. So it's not out and available for people to breathe or to absorb or whatever.
Will it vaporize even if it's adhered to this? Because I hear about it.
No, it won't volatilize that way. The way it's absorbed, right? Because otherwise, mercury, elemental and liquid, is very volatile.
Right.
But not in that matrix.
Okay. Other questions? Thank you very much for your time. I appreciate your testimony this morning.
Thank you.
Now we have Jane Myers from the Dental Association and Daniel Soce. There's a dentist, and I'm just going to be totally outrageous and say I'm looking forward to this testimony because you're supposed to be Judith's dentist. Is that correct?
Yes, I am. I'm proud to be.
So if you have any good stories about her, would you please pass them on after the committee?
Yes, great oral home care.
Great oral. Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jane Myers. I represent the Oregon Dental Association, and Dr. Dan Soce, a Salem dentist, a general dentist, is with us today. Just as a backup if you have a technical question. We don't have a lot to say about the bill. The only reason we're testifying at all is we wanted to get it on the record that our understanding is Senate Bill 818 doesn't include dentists as manufacturers when they're using dental amalgam. And I think we're pretty comfortable from discussions we've had now this morning. Thank you for the opportunity to talk to or hear from the sponsor of the bill and the Oregon Environmental Council that it is not their intention to include dentists as manufacturers or dental amalgam under the bill.
I do have a question for you, and I had not thought about this question until 5 seconds ago, so it's probably not well thought through. I had a fascinating conversation with Senator Morris, who at one time had fillings with mercury in them. He spent a lifetime, he said, of allergies. And when he had those fillings all replaced, and you're welcome to talk to him yourself, he said that his allergies went away, and he attributed that to the mercury in his fillings. What kind of response would you have to that? I was fascinated by what he said, but of course it was just anecdotal information. Is there some scientific basis for this, or what's the story?
I'm Dr. Dan Soce. I'm a dentist here in Salem. I think that the main thing about making scientific decisions is that you've got to have 32 people in the study. You've got to have the people who are running the study not know who is who in the study. And anecdotal information isn't really science.
Mm-hmm.
And some people have all kinds of modalities of treatment, and things happen. Things change afterwards. From what we know in science, the medical science approach with the valid studies, that the silver fillings are not clinically a problem, are not a problem for people. Some people are allergic to less than 1% it's less than 1%, it's not 1%, have some allergies. And what is an allergy? An allergy is a local reaction or an irritation or something like that. It's not it's a small problem that can be dealt with. It's not a big problem.
Okay.
I don't disagree that having this. We have. I do know that there was a fellow, Dr. Huggins in Colorado, who originally started the silver filling issue. He had people take the fillings out on Friday, and on Monday they walked. That's not possible. It has to get out of your system. It has to be. It's when you look at it more closely, it just doesn't happen like that. It's in the mercury is in the air. It's everywhere, and it just doesn't go away when you take 4 or 10 or little pieces of silver out of your mouth. It's not. Mm-hmm. It doesn't go away like that. If it's having systemic issues.
Yeah. Okay. I was just fascinated by what that conversation. You know, it was just a quiet conversation we had. I guess it came up because of maybe it was this bill earlier. You know, I wasn't even aware of this bill at the time. It was a fascinating conversation. It was the first time I'd talked to somebody that had some firsthand experience with it.
I'm kind of, my, as a dentist, and this is one of the tools in my bag of tricks, is that anecdotal stuff isn't taken as science.
Mm-hmm.
That's just a,
right.
You know, that's a real tricky kind of thing, and we all know someone who's they laid on the hands and the lame walked.
Right.
But let's make sure we can do it 32 times. And
32 times with people that never talk to one another.
Yeah.
That's
right. Senator Shields and any members of the committee would be happy to follow up with whatever the science you need to analyze your own answer to that question after the meeting, if you'd like.
Well, I was, like I said, mostly yeah. It was just intellectual curiosity. Are there other questions that any of you would have? Thank you for coming and sharing with us this morning. And
it's a vital issue in dentistry right now, and so anytime we hear the opportunity to share, you know, where we're coming from, I appreciate it.
When you say it's a vital issue in dentistry, how do you mean that?
I think it's commonly used. There is no substitute for it in treatment of cavities in certain areas. There's just no substitute for it, and we're going to have people that have cavities that can't be treated effectively like we have now, and dentistry has come a long way in the last 150 years since silver fillings have been around, and we don't want to go backwards on that.
Now you've got me confused, because if there's no alternative, I remember talking to a chiropractor who said he had all of his silver fillings replaced. What did he replace them with?
Plastic or gold. Gold is the best answer for, but you know, you don't want something gold up in front, and the plastic white fillings are, they look a lot better.
But are they, they're inferior?
They're not as durable.
Okay. I see.
You know, it's compromises people make. The dentist and the patient kind of discuss what the options are, and then they make a decision.
Well, thank you. That's very good information. I appreciate
thank
it.
You.
Thanks a lot.
Going down the list, Andy.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Fisher.
I can't imagine why anybody objects to having gold in their front teeth when they stick something in their tongue.
That's true. But, you know, that's an age thing, Senator Fisher. I was thinking differently. I was thinking in this economy, people would be glad to show off gold anytime they could, you know. But Andy Harris, right?
Yes.
Thank you very much for coming this morning. Welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Senator Shields, and appreciate the opportunity to address the committee. I'm Andy Harris. I'm a physician in Salem. I've lived here since 1974. Mercury is a highly toxic and persistent chemical that can have profound and long-term impacts on the brain and nervous system. Mercury is dangerous for infants and children, and the developing brain of the fetus is uniquely vulnerable to mercury. Methylmercury readily crosses the human placenta, and levels have been shown to be 30% higher in fetal red blood cells than in the mother's red cells. Fetal exposure to methylmercury can lead to a range of serious problems in childhood, including brain damage, mental retardation, poor coordination, speech difficulties, impaired learning capacity, delays in walking, disturbances of gait, attention deficit, poor memory, and seizures. On January 31st of this year, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, that's the CDC, released the most comprehensive report on human exposure to environmental chemicals ever completed. The blood and urine of nearly 2,500 Americans were tested for 116 chemicals. One of the CDC's findings was that 1 in 10 women of childbearing age have enough mercury in their bodies to put their unborn children at risk of neurologic damage from mercury. In addition, the EPA estimates that about 7% of women in the U.S. of childbearing age consume methylmercury in excess of the safe dosage.
How is that? How do they consume it?
They consume it usually through eating fish, but they may get it from other sources.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
When released into the environment, mercury persists and builds up in the aquatic food chain, making certain fish unsafe to eat. Because mercury increases in concentrations that moves up the food chain, food chain. Fish and other animals higher on the food chain have a much higher concentration of mercury than fish lower on the food chain. Oregon has fish consumption advisories for 11 lakes and rivers, including the Willamette River, due to the threat of mercury on fetal brain development. Large predator ocean fish like swordfish and some tuna also may be sufficiently contaminated to pose a risk, particularly when eaten on a regular basis. Consumers need information on the mercury content of mercury-added products that they purchase. The 2001 legislature passed legislation to reduce mercury pollution by phasing out certain commonly used products such as thermometers and thermostats. That bill was a good first step, but there are still many other sources of mercury, such as fluorescent light tubes, switches, and relays. These mercury-containing products need to be labeled and also need to be disposed of properly. Senate Bill 818 develops a collection system for disposing of these products at the end of their useful lifespan. Almost none of the industrial facilities in Oregon that emit mercury to the environment are now required to monitor their emissions, the exception being the municipal waste incinerators, as you just heard from Marion County. Nor are they required to limit emissions according to the terms of their air or water permits. SB 818 offers a reasonable means for industrial facilities that emit mercury in Oregon to monitor their emissions and eventually limit their emissions by 50%. SB 818 addresses a public health issue. Action on this bill now will improve the health of Oregon's children and will save the state and healthcare system substantial sums of money over the long term.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Fisher.
Are the newborn screenings that we've set up in Oregon, did any of that pertain to the showing whether we have a mercury problem amongst our children?
We have a mercury problem everywhere in the United States, yes.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Fisher.
I answered my question. That
yeah.
The monitoring that we do test for mercury.
I can't answer that specifically. I don't have that information.
Is there anybody here that can answer that question? Gail Shibley is coming forward. We knew we'd find some reason for you to sit here this morning.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senator Fisher, it's a great question. I was just in the lab last Friday, and I would be happy to check with the director of our lab, Dr. Mike Skeels. We do, parenthetically, provide newborn screening for 5 states, including the state of Oregon. We test for different things depending on what those states ask of us to do by contract. But I will find out in terms of what we test for here in Oregon.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Fisher.
It would seem like that would be a very fairly simple way of checking a whole lot more than 2,500 situations and find out exactly what the effect was. And if it's were evident with that, if we've got that easy way of getting information on what's happening with the newborns in 5 states, it shouldn't take very long to find out whether we're on a reasonable course or a totally unreasonable course.
I guess my question would be how complex would it be to check? And that's a question I'm sure you can't answer, but Mike Skeels could probably give you an answer to that question.
Mr. Chair, you're absolutely right. I'll make sure that I'm sure that he would give you a great bit of information that, in terms of the newborn test screening program and the kinds of things they test for, and particularly as it may relate to the issue we're here today about.
Okay. Can you get something at least to me, and I'll get it to the other senators on the committee or whatever you want to do.
Immediately, if not sooner. Thank you.
That's a great answer. Are there other questions for Dr. Harris? Thank you very much for your time. I kind of had to twist his arm to get him to do it. He gets tired of showing up in front of this committee, but I asked Bob Danko if he would come to give us just a quick kind of thumbnail sketch overview of DEQ's present program. And I realize that I may be giving an impossible task when I say give us a quick overview, but I just want to set this bill in the context of the whole thing and in the context of the the mining bill that we listened to last week and so on.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Bob Danko with the Department of Environmental Quality. I thank you for the opportunity to speak today. I'm going to keep my comments brief, as you suggested. I'm smart to do that, I'm sure. We appreciate the efforts of Senator Devlin and of the Oregon Environmental Council to focus on mercury and to bring this bill forward. We and they have the same goals and to cut mercury releases into Oregon's environment. This follows the 2001 mercury bill that passed this legislature, and I think that we, Oregon Environmental Council, and the industry stakeholders it affected have done a good job in implementing that 2001 law. I think we've done that quite well, and it was a good team approach. I think a good example of how various interests can get together to implement a law that passes this body. Our director, Stephanie Halleck, has established four key areas for our department to focus on, and one of those is addressing toxics in Oregon's environment. And over the last year or two, mercury has been the focus of our work on toxics. We also have a key direction of involving Oregonians in finding ways to help Oregon environment and finding solutions. And mercury and addressing mercury in Oregon falls into that category also. I passed out a fact sheet, a one-page fact sheet that summarizes the work we have been doing and are aiming to do in the mercury area. Actually, the fact sheet is a summary of a 23-page report that we put together on mercury for our Environmental Quality Commission last December, and I'd be happy to provide that to the committee. We're going to report back to our Environmental Quality Commission in about the end of this year on kind of a progress report on how we're doing. Basically, in 10 words or less, our strategy right now on mercury is to refine our estimates of releases with those that are doing the releasing, with the stakeholders, the industry sectors, the product manufacturers, and so on, to get a better handle on exactly what the numbers are. We have made some estimates over the last a few months, but we would feel much more comfortable refining those numbers. And then, of course, the second part of the strategy is to sitting down with what we call sectors, if it's a different industry sectors or different manufacturing sectors, to work on voluntary strategies to see where we can get the mercury emissions being reduced. One part of our strategy, of course, was last week before you in SB 817 dealing with abandoned mines, and we hope that this committee will, when we come back with amendments, will hopefully act favorably on that bill that was before you last week. So, in summary, I see this bill before you today very similar to the bill that passed last session. And what it will take, I think, Mr. Chair, is either you or a member of the committee calling the various stakeholders together, sitting down and trying to work out a consensus on how to move forward. That's what happened last time, and I think we implemented that bill last time quite well, and that's what I think is going to have to happen this time.
Okay. Thank you. Are there any questions? If not, thank you for coming this morning, Bob. We appreciate it. I was reminded a while back by one of our fine senators that the committee is supposed to start at 8 o'clock and end at 10, and we're 1 minute after 10. So I'm going to ask both of you senators, shall we adjourn and just hold over the other two bills, which we can do very briefly, or do you want to take them on?
It's a pleasure, Mr. Chair, I say.
Senator Fisher, do you have a few minutes? If that's the case, I don't think anybody's signed up to speak on these bills anyway, are there? Yes, I should close the public hearing. Thank you very much on Senate Bill 818. And we could then, if that's okay with everybody, open a hearing possible work session on 2158.
Thank you, Mr. Chair's members. House Bill 2158 comes at the request of the Department of Administrative Services. It passed the House 56-0. The measure revises the intent of the Legislative Assembly regarding state recycling programs. directs DAS to continue the current state recycling programs for employees of state government. It authorizes the Department of Administrative Services to contract as necessary for the recycling of products collected. It does delete the requirement for a separate recycling plan for the Legislative Assembly, as well as deleting provisions concerning the use of revenues or savings realized from recycling programs. I did provide the repealed sections for your easy review. It is part of the statutes that has across the top public contracts and purchasing. Those are the two repealed sections, 279.640 and 279.645. We have received a no revenue and a no fiscal impact statement on this measure. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Judith. Nobody signed up to comment on the bill. Is there any discussion of the bill, or do you want to go straight into a work session on the bill?
I'm with me.
We'll close the public hearing and open a work session on Senate Bill 2158.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2158 to the floor for the pass recommendation.
Senator Beyer moves Senate Bill 2158 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? If not, let's call the roll.
Senator Corcoran. Senator Fisher.
Aye.
Vice Chair Beyer.
Aye.
Chair Shields.
Aye. Senate Bill, or House Bill 2158 is declared passed. And I'll just ask Senator Beyer if he'll carry it.
Let's put it on the consent calendar.
Oh, yeah, we could put it on the consent calendar. Is that okay? Do we have to do anything to do that?
It just slows it down for 3 days.
That's fine.
Oh, you have to have four of us to put it on consent. Without him, we can't do that. Without.
All right.
Okay, we'll slow it down then. I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2146 and open, 2158 is what I'm closing, and we're opening one on House Bill 2546. Judith is racing to keep up with us here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. House Bill 2546 comes to us from the House with a 54-2 vote. Representatives Patridge and Berger were the dissenting votes on this measure. House Bill 2546 deletes the requirement that government fleet vehicles annually certify compliance with pollution control equipment requirements, basically changing that from a annual to a biennial requirement. We have received a no revenue impact statement, and I'm showing that we do have a fiscal statement issued. And while you're discussing the bill, I don't find that in my bill file, but I do want to make sure the members are clear about the fiscal, so I'm going to run upstairs and get that out of the bill file.
Okay. I have some notes here. The motor pool vehicles are maintained more often than private vehicles, and so if anything, they really need less frequent inspections rather than the more frequent ones that we require. I notice also that Susan Schneider is signed up, so I'm going to ask her to come up and give us some testimony. She has with her Roger Johnson, is that right? Okay. Thank you for coming to our committee this morning. You've been abandoned. You're the only ones left. You can tell there's lots of interest in this issue.
Good morning, Chair Shields and members of the committee. We appreciate the opportunity to be here. My name is Susan Schneider with the Office of Government Relations for the City of Portland. With me is Roger Johnson with the City's Fleet Services Section. We urge your support today of House Bill 2546. It's a bill that also passed the House during the last session and ran out of time on the Senate side. This bill deletes the requirement that government certify vehicle emissions compliance annually instead of on the same schedule as all other vehicles, which is every other year. All vehicles within the designated geographic areas, like Portland's, are required to ensure compliance with state DEQ standards by completing a test and certification process. This must be done every 2 years, except that government fleets of over 50 vehicles must do it annually. The City of Portland is very supportive of the intent of vehicle emissions testing, and we fully cooperate with the state's DEQ to provide complete and accurate certification for all designated vehicles. Realizing the clean air implications and the economic value of well-maintained vehicles, we establish regularly scheduled maintenance programs providing accurate replacement of repair components by trained professional mechanics. City vehicles consistently pass the state's DEQ vehicle emission tests. The City of Portland understands the leadership role of government in this issue. However, this responsibility should not be interpreted to spend time and money without meaningful results, we feel. The testing highly compliant and regularly maintained vehicles twice as often as less compliant vehicles doesn't contribute to the goals of the vehicle emissions testing program. In fact, it represents an unnecessary cost to taxpayers. This bill is basically an efficiency in government sort of bill. It's what raises the issue in the first place. An annual test and certification is currently required of 1,450 City of Portland vehicles. If this were changed to the same standard as all non-government vehicles, we would test 725 vehicles a year. This would save the taxpayers approximately $30,000 a year in maintenance costs and far more in reduced vehicle availability. Basically, when a vehicle is in the garage for an emissions test, it's not available to be in the field. It's not possible for us to place a dollar value on that. It is a significant out-of-service time, particularly for services like police patrol cars. And it's not, we don't believe, an efficient use of government funds. If our understanding that DEQ does not have any concerns with this proposal, neither do they or we know exactly why it was included in the legislation originally. We surmise that it was when the whole issue of vehicle emissions testing started, it was so that large government entities could demonstrate leadership on the air quality issue. The bill will not impact air quality in the attainment area, which is a very big concern to us and to the industries in Portland.
Okay, thank you.
Happy to answer questions.
Roger, do you have anything to add to this?
Well, I was just here to answer some questions.
Okay, if we have any.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Fisher.
We do not have that same requirement for private fleets with or nonprofit fleets of over 50 vehicles.
Mr. Chair, Senator Fisher, we do not.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Meyer.
Thank you. The one sentence in your written statement, I don't know if you said it or not. I was looking at fiscal and I didn't pay any attention, but it says this would save taxpayers approximately $30,000 a year in maintenance costs. I'm curious to know how this repealing this requirement is going to save money in maintenance cost.
Mr. Chair, Senator Meyer, Roger Johnson, Director of Vehicle Services with the City of Portland. We are required as part of our compliance to actually test the vehicle, prepare certifications, provide that information, DEQ, store that information ourselves. So it's a test we would not normally perform.
Mr. Chair, Senator Breyer, if I may expand on that a bit. So the saving is not in the maintenance of the vehicle itself. The saving is in doing the test, preparing the certification, storing the information, and transmitting it to DEQ.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair, because that's, and my point would be that is different than maintenance costs. Costs, what that tells me is that you are currently doing maintenance on vehicles that you are either going to stop doing or that you are doing just to meet the test.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. That's why I wanted to clarify that.
Right.
Yes.
It fits under that category, but it's not actually physical maintenance. You're not changing any spark plugs or anything like that. You're
Chair, Senator Beyer, we will not do less maintenance of the vehicle. We will do less testing.
Senator Fisher, question.
Yes, Mr. Chair, some of the indications we have from the state vehicles is that those test costs between $10 and $21 per vehicle. How does Portland, with 1,450 vehicles, get by with and only save $30,000? It looked like they ought to be saving over $1 million.
Mr. Chair, Senator Fisher,
right.
I'm not
maybe over $100,000.
Yep. I'm not familiar with the numbers you have for the state. Our information is simply for the city.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Senator Fisher, it's hard to know without going back and talking to them whether they included, maybe they included some of the out-of-service time that costs, which we were not able to quantify. It's hard to know.
Mr. Chair.
If it saves us more money, we will be delighted.
So we're quibbling over whether it saves $30,000 or maybe more than $30,000 at this point. Senator Mulder.
Who tests your vehicles? Do you do it yourself or do you have to run through the DEQ test stations like everybody else does?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, we actually have folks who are certified. They need to be certified by DEQ as testers. They need to receive training as testers. And then we test the vehicles ourselves, and we certify them as compliant, and we provide the information to DEQ. We work closely with DEQ, but we're able to certify our own vehicles.
And do you do that on the odd year when you don't have to actually take it to DEQ, or do you always do it for yourself?
Mr. Chair, we do it every year simply because when you suggest the odd year, that's actually the point here. We are required to certify every single year. So we test it ourselves every year.
My question is, if you didn't have this program, would you be running these vehicles through the DEQ testing facilities every other year like the rest of the population does, or would you still be doing them at a site of your own that's not out of the DEQ site?
Mr. Chair, do you mean if this bill becomes law, would
right.
we continue to certify on-site?
Right.
Mr. Chair, we would probably continue to certify on-site.
But you'd only have to do it every other year, and therefore you'd save the $30,000 you're talking about. And you'd keep your vehicles out on the street. Your police cars wouldn't be sitting in there. They'd be out in the street.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Yes. Okay. Senator Fisher.
Yeah, this according, they would do it every half their vehicles, 1 year and half
right.
their vehicles the other year, according to the way I read this. And at a cost, if you take 725 vehicles, that's about $4.
Per vehicle.
No, it's about $40 a year. Why are they so much more than the state?
Mr. Chair, Senator Fisher, again, I think it depends on what has been included in the state's number and our number, and we'd have to talk to them to find out what that is.
Right.
It's a savings for both of us. Depending
okay.
on how you calculate it.
Senator Beyer.
Thank you. Do other private fleets or does anyone else have the ability to certify their own vehicles in the PG in the DEQ area test areas?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, I'm hoping Bob Danko was still here. I can't answer that question. On behalf of DEQ, I don't know.
Well, I'm curious, Mr. Chair, as to why the City of Portland has an exemption to be able to allow them to test their own vehicles, where it says here that the state vehicles have to go through the DEQ tests, and I'm curious now if any other private fleets with 50 more vehicles are allowed to certify their own vehicles. That seems like there's an inconsistency if that's the case, that the City of Portland has granted an exception to DEQ for some reason.
Well, again, Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, I'm not aware of the DEQ rules. I know that most public fleets have that opportunity if they're authorized by DEQ.
But in other words, DEQ certifies, in a sense, that your testing of your vehicles is equivalent to their testing. Now, obviously, that would have to be the case. And what you're saying is that any other fleet of vehicles, whether privately or publicly owned, could probably get that same kind of certification with DEQ?
Mr. Chair, we are aware, Senator Barr, we're aware that other public fleets can, and it may very well be that privates do as well. Don't know that. Probably somebody from PGE or one of the others that have big fleets could tell you that quickly. I'm not aware of that.
Yeah. Are there any other questions? DEQ is on their way back if we want to sit here for a few minutes and wait for them.
Well, Chair, I have an appointment.
I don't have a problem with this bill. I mean, it passed 54-2 or something on the House side, and it passed in a previous session.
You know, Mr. Chair, I don't have a problem either. If providing that we're not treating the city of Portland differently than we're treating other fleets,
right.
I mean public or private fleets, because if that's what it was, then I do have a problem with it, because we typically put exemptions in for so government doesn't have to comply with the rules that private sector does, that bothers me when we do that.
Right. That's I hear you.
I support the bill if it makes it equivalent across the board, but if DEQ still has allowed the city of Portland a separate system than everyone else has, then I have a problem with the bill.
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, I can reassure you that city of Portland doesn't get a special situation. I don't know how they set up their certification for fleets inspections and whether it's confined to public fleets. All public fleets. We're not a special exception. I can assure you of that. I don't know if they treat all public fleets different than all private fleets, or they treat all fleets the same, which I think is your question.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
ODOT runs theirs through their own program in Medford, so apparently it's possible for others to do their own program.
Oh, okay. I don't want to be lighthearted, but I'm absolutely convinced that your colleagues in the House would have asked the same question, you know, and made sure that Portland wasn't getting some kind of a special break. I mean, that's consistent with their history in the House of making sure that Portland adheres to the rules that everybody else has to play with. I wish DEQ were here and could answer the question themselves. And I'm aware that Senator Fisher needs to leave, and so
let's get it for work session on Wednesday. Work session only.
Okay, we'll have a work session only on Wednesday. Is that okay?
Mr. Chair, before you adjourn us, there was a letter from NEPA here that I think ought to be included in the testimony this morning on 818.
This was in my file, wasn't it?
No, it's in your file, but it wasn't put on record.
Okay, I want to note for the record. Well, let's close the hearing on House Bill 2546. We'll plan on having a very brief work session on it on Wednesday.
Process.
And just for the record, I'll note that written testimony on Senate Bill 818 was received from Rick Erdheim, Senior Manager of Government Affairs for NEMA. Okay. Thank you, Senator Fisher. I appreciate you bringing that to our attention. And with that, I'm going to adjourn the Senate Ag and Natural Resources Committee.